drifting the cloud to port, rather quickly. Where's the big target?
Dead ahead, about 100 yards. Let's make sure we see what that is.
Right, going forward. There's something... looks like a butcher knife. Want it?
No, let's keep going.
Okay, range?
60 yards. Ought to be seeing it soon.
The two officers saw it on TV the same time Overton did. Just a spectral image at first. It faded like an afterimage in one's eye. Then it came back. Overton was the first to react.
Damn!
It was more than 30 feet long, and appeared perfectly round. They approached from its rear, and saw the main circle, and within it, 4 smaller cones that stuck out a foot or so.
That's a missile, Skipper! A whole fucking rusky nuclear missile!
Hold position, Jess.
Aye, aye.
He backed off on the power controls.
You said she was a victor, Johnson said to the Soviet.
I was mistaken.
Kaganovich's mouth twitched.
Let's take a closer look, Jess.
The sea cliff moved forward, up the side of the rocket body. The Cyrillic lettering was unmistakable, though they were too far off to make out the serial numbers. There was a new treasure for Davy Jones, an SSN-20 Seahawk, with its 8 500-kiloton MIRVs. Kaganovich was careful to note the markings on the missile body. He'd been briefed on the Seahawk immediately before flying from the Kiev. As an intelligence officer, he ordinarily knew more about American weapons than their Soviet counterparts. How convenient, he thought. The Americans had allowed him to ride in one of their most advanced research vessels whose internal arrangements he had already memorized, and had accomplished his mission for him. The Red October was dead. All he had to do was get that information to Admiral Stralbo on the Kirov, and the fleet could leave the American coast. Let them come to the Norwegian Sea to play their nasty games. See who would win them up there.
Position check, Jess. Mark the sucker.
Aye. Overton pressed a button to deploy a sonar transponder that would respond only to a coded American sonar signal. This would guide them back to the missile. They would return later with their heavy lift rig to put a line on the missile and haul it to the surface.
That is the property of the Soviet Union, Kaganovich pointed out. It is under international waters. It belongs to my country.
Then you can fucking come and get it, snapped the American seaman. He must be an officer in disguise, Kaganovich thought.
Beg pardon, Mr. Johnson.
We'll be back for it, Johnson said.
You'll never lift it. It is too heavy, Kaganovich objected.
I suppose you're right, Johnson smiled. Kaganovich allowed the Americans their small victory. It could have been worse. Much worse.
Shall we continue to search for more wreckage?
No, I think we'll go back up, Johnson decided.
But your orders?
My orders, Captain Kaganovich, were to search for the remains of a Victor-class attack submarine. We found the grave of a boomer. You lied to us, Captain, and our courtesy to you ends at this point. You got what you wanted, I guess. Later we'll be back for what we want. Johnson reached up and pulled the release handle for the iron ballast. The metal slab dropped free. This gave the sea cliff 1,000 pounds of positive buoyancy. There was no way to stay down now, even if they wanted to.
Home, Jess.
Aye, aye, Skipper.
The ride back to the surface was a silent one. The USS Austin. An hour later, Kaganovich climbed to the Austin's bridge and requested permission to send a message to the Kirov. This had been agreed upon beforehand, else the Austin's commanding officer would have refused. Word on the dead sub's identity had spread fast. The Soviet officer broadcast a series of code words accompanied by the serial number from the depth gauge dial. These were acknowledged at once. Overton and Johnson watched the Russian board the helicopter, carrying the depth gauge dial.
I didn't like him much, Mr. Johnson. Captain Kagana, bitch. That name sounds like a terminal stutter.
We snookered him, didn't we?
Remind me never to play cards with you, Jess.
The Red October. Ryan woke up after 6 hours to music that seemed dreamily familiar. He lay in his bunk for a minute, trying to place it, then slipped his feet into his shoes and went forward to the wardroom. It was E.T. Ryan arrived just in time to see the credits scrolling up the 13-inch TV set sitting on the forward end of the wardroom table. Most of the Russian officers and 3 Americans had been watching it. The Russians were all dabbing their eyes. Jack got a cup of coffee and sat at the end of the table.
"You like it?"
"It was magnificent," Borodin proclaimed.
Lieutenant Mannion chuckled.
"Second time we ran it."
One of the Russians started speaking rapidly in his native language. Borodin translated for him.
"He asks if all American children act with such... Bugayev... Svobodno?"
"Free," Bugayev translated. Incorrectly, but close enough. Ryan laughed.
"I never did, but the movie was set in California. People out there are a little crazy."
"The truth is, no. Kids don't act like that. At least I've never seen it. And I have too. At the same time, we do raise our kids to be a lot more independent than Soviet parents do."
Borodin translated, and then gave the Russian response.
"So, all American children are not such hooligans."
"Some are. America's not perfect, gentlemen. We make lots of mistakes."
Ryan had decided to tell the truth, insofar as he could. Borodin translated again. The reactions around the table were a little dubious.
"I have told them this movie is a child's story and should not be taken too seriously. This is so?"
"Yes, sir,"
Mancuso, who had just come in, said.
"It's a kid's story, but I've seen it 5 times. Welcome back, Ryan."
"Thank you, Commander. I take it you have things under control?"
"Yep. I guess we all needed the chance to unwind. I'll have to write Jonesy another commendation letter. This really was a good idea."
He waved at the television.
"We have lots of time to be serious."
Noise came in.
"How's Williams?"
Ryan asked.
"He'll make it."
Noise filled his cup. "I had him open for 3.5 hours. The head wound was superficial, bloody as hell, but head wounds are like that. The chest was a close one, though. The bullet missed the pericardium by a whisker.
Captain Borodin, who gave that man first aid?"
The Starpom pointed to a lieutenant.
"He does not speak English."
"Tell him that Williams owes him his life. Putting that chest tube in was the difference. He would have died without it."
"You're sure he'll make it?" Ryan persisted.
"Of course he'll make it, Ryan. That's what I do for a living. He'll be a sick boy for a while, and I'd feel better if we had him in a real hospital. But everything's under control."
"And Captain Ramius?" Borodin asked.
"No problem. He's still sleeping. I took my time sewing it up. Ask him where he got his first aid training."
Borodin did.
"He says he likes to read medical books."
"How old is he?"
24.
"Tell him if he ever wants to study medicine, I'll tell him how to get started. If he knows how to do the right thing at the right time, he might just be good enough to do it for a living."
The young officer was pleased by this comment and asked how much money a doctor could make in America.
"I'm in the service, so I don't make very much.
$48,000 a year, counting flight pay. I could do a lot better on the outside."
"In the Soviet Union," Borodin pointed out, "doctors are paid the same as factory workers."
"Maybe that explains why your docs are no good," Noise observed.
"When will the captain be able to resume command?"
Borodin asked.
"I'm going to keep him down all day," Noise said. "I don't want him to start bleeding again. He can start moving around tomorrow. Carefully. I don't want him on that leg too much. He'll be fine, gentlemen, a little weak from the blood loss, but he'll recover fully."
Noise made his pronouncements as though he were quoting physical laws.
"We thank you, Doctor," Borodin said.
Noise shrugged.
"It's what they pay me for. Now, can I ask a question? What the hell is going on here?"
Borodin laughed, translating the question for his comrades.
"We will all become American citizens."
"And you're bringing a sub along with you, huh? Son of a gun. For a while there, I thought this was some sort of a... I don't know, something. This is quite a story. Guess I can't tell it to anybody, though."
Correct, Doctor, Ryan smiled.
Too bad, Noyes muttered as he headed back to sickbay.
Moscow. So, Comrade Admiral, you report success to us?
Narmanov asked.
Yes, Comrade General Secretary, Gorshkov nodded, surveying the conference table in the underground command center. All of the inner circle were here, along with the military chiefs and the head of the KGB,
Admiral Strelbo's fleet intelligence officer, Captain Kaganovich, was permitted by the Americans to view the wreckage from aboard one of their deep submergence research vessels. The craft recovered a fragment of wreckage, a depth gauge dial. These objects are numbered, and the number was immediately relayed to Moscow. It was positively from Red October. Kaganovich also inspected a missile blasted loose from the submarine. It was definitely a Seahawk. Red October is dead. Our mission is accomplished.
By chance, Comrade Admiral. Not by design, Mikhail Alexandrov pointed out. Your fleet failed in its mission to locate and destroy the submarine. I think Comrade Gerasimov has some information for us.
Nikolai Gerasimov was the new KGB chief. He had already given his report to the political members of this group, and was eager to release it to these strutting peacocks in uniform. He wanted to see their reactions. The KGB had scores to settle with these men. Gerasimov summarized the report he had from Agent Cassius.
Impossible! Gorshkov snapped.
Perhaps, Gerasimov conceded politely. There is a strong probability that this is a very clever piece of disinformation. It is now being investigated by our agents in the field. There are, however, some interesting details which support this hypothesis. Permit me to review them, Comrade Admiral. First, why did the Americans allow our men aboard one of their most sophisticated research submarines? Second, why did they cooperate with us at all, saving our sailor from the Politovsky and telling us about it? They let us see our men immediately. Why? Why not keep our men, use him and dispose of him? Sentimentality? I think not. Third, at the same time they picked this man up, their air and fleet units were harassing our fleet in the most blatant and aggressive manner. This suddenly stopped, and a day later they were tripping over their own feet in their efforts to assist in our search and rescue.
Because Strelbo wisely and courageously decided to refrain from reacting to their provocations, Gorshkov replied.
Gerasimov nodded politely again.
Perhaps so. That was an intelligent decision on the Admiral's part. It cannot be easy for a uniformed officer to swallow his pride so. On the other hand, I speculate that it is also possible that about this time the Americans received this information which Cassius passed on to us. I further speculate that the Americans were fearful of our reaction were we to suspect that they had perpetrated this entire affair as a CIA operation. We know now that several imperialist intelligence services are inquiring as to the reason for this fleet operation. Over the past 2 days, we have been doing some fast checking of our own. We find, Gerasimov consulted his notes, that there are 29 Polish engineers at the Polyarny submarine yard, mainly in quality control and inspection posts, that mail and message handling procedures are very lax, and that Captain Romius did not, as he supposedly threatened in his letter to Comrade Podorin, sail his submarine into New York Harbor, but was rather in a position 1,000 kilometers south when the submarine was destroyed. That was an obvious piece of disinformation on Romius's part, Gorshkov objected. Romius was both baiting us and deliberately misleading us. For that reason we deployed our fleet at all of the American ports.
And never did find him, Alexandrov noted quietly. Go on, comrade.
Gerasimov continued.
Whatever port he was supposedly heading for, he was over 500 kilometers for many of them, and we are certain that he could have reached any of them on a direct course. In fact, Comrade Admiral, as you reported in your initial briefing, he could have reached the American coast within 7 days of leaving port. To do that, as I explained at length last week, would have meant traveling at maximum speed. Missile submarine commanders prefer not to do this, Gorshkov said.
I can understand it, Alexandrov observed, in view of the fate of the Politovsky.
But you would expect a traitor to the Rodina to run like a thief.
Into the trap we set, Gorshkov replied.
Which failed, Narmanov commented.
I do not claim that this story is true, nor do I claim it is even a likely one at this point,
Gerasimov said, keeping his voice detached and clinical.
But there is sufficient circumstantial evidence supporting it that I must recommend an in-depth investigation by the Committee for State Security touching on all aspects of this affair.
Security in my yards is a naval and GRU matter, Gorshkov said.
No longer, Narmanov announced the decision reached 2 hours earlier.
The KGB will investigate this shameful business along two lines. One group will investigate the information from our agent in Washington. The other will proceed on the assumption that the letter from, allegedly from, Captain Romius was genuine. If this was a traitorous conspiracy, it could only have been possible because Romius was able under current regulations and practices to choose his own officers. The Committee for State Security will report to us on the desirability of continuing this practice, on the current degree of control ship captains have over the careers of their officers, and over party control of the fleet. I think we will begin our reforms by allowing officers to transfer from one ship to another with greater frequency. If officers stay in one place too long, obviously they may develop confusion in their loyalties.
What you suggest will destroy the efficiency of my fleet, Gorshkov pounded on the table.
It was a mistake.
The People's Fleet, Comrade Admiral, Alexandrov corrected.
The Party's Fleet.
Gorshkov knew where that idea came from. Narmanov still had Alexandrov's support. That made the Comrade General Secretary's position secure, and that meant the positions of other men around this table were not. Which men? Podorin's mind revolted at the suggestion from the KGB. What did those bastard spies know about the Navy? Or the Party? They were all corrupt opportunists. Andropov had proven that, and the Politburo was now letting this whelp Gerasimov attack the armed services, which safeguarded the nation against the imperialists, had saved it from Andropov's clique, and had never been anything but the stalwart servants of the Party. But it does all fit, doesn't it? He thought. Just as Khrushchev had deposed Zhukov, the man who made his succession possible when Beria was done away with. So these bastards would now play the KGB against the uniformed men who had made their position safe in the first place.
As for you, Comrade Podorin, Alexandrov went on.
Yes, Comrade Academician.
For Podorin, there was no apparent escape. The main political administration had passed final approval on Romius's appointment. If Romius were indeed a traitor, then Podorin stood condemned for gross misjudgment. But if Romius had been an unknowing pawn, then Podorin, along with Gorshkov, had been duped into precipitous action.
Narmanov took his cue from Alexandrov. Comrade Admiral, we find that your secret provisions to safeguard the security of the submarine Red October were successfully implemented. Unless, that is, Captain Romius was blameless and scuttled the ship himself, along with his officers and the Americans who were doubtless trying to steal it. In either case, pending the KGB's inspection of the parts recovered from the wreck, it would appear that the submarine did not fall into enemy hands.
Podorin blinked several times. His heart was beating fast, and he could feel a twinge of pain in his left chest. Was he being let off? Why? It took him a second to understand. He was the political officer, after all. If the Party was seeking to re-establish political control over the fleet, no, to reassert what never had been lost, then the Politburo could not afford to depose the Party's representative in high command. This would make him the vassal of these men, Alexandrov especially. Podorin decided
that he could live with that. And it made Gorshkov's position extremely vulnerable. Though it would take some months, Podorin was sure that the Russian fleet would have a new chief, one whose personal power would not be sufficient to make policy without Politburo approval. Gorshkov had become too big, too powerful, and the party chieftains did not wish to have a man with so much personal prestige in high command. "I have my head," Podorin thought to himself, amazed at his good fortune.
"Comrade Gerasimov," Narmanov went on, "we'll be working with the political security section of your office to review your procedures and to offer suggestions for improvements."
So, now he became the KGB's spy in high command? Well, he had his head, his office, his dasha, and his pension in 2 years. It was a small price to pay. Podorin was more than content.
The 16th day. Saturday, 18th December. The East Coast. The USS Pigeon arrived at her dock in Charleston at 4 a.m. The Soviet crewmen, quartered in the crew's mess, had become a handful for everyone. As much as the Russian officers had worked to limit contact between their charges and their American rescuers, this had never really been possible. To state it simply, they had been unable to block the call of nature. The Pigeon had stuffed her visitors with good Navy chow, and the nearest head was a few yards aft. On the way to and from the facilities, the Red October's crewmen met with American soldiers, some of whom were Russian-speaking officers disguised as enlisted men, others of whom were Russian language specialists in the enlisted rates flown out just as the last load of Soviets had arrived aboard. The fact that they were aboard a putatively hostile vessel and had found friendly Russian-speaking men had been overpowering for many of the young conscripts. Their remarks had been recorded on hidden tape machines for later examination in Washington. Petrov and the three junior officers had been slow to catch on, but when they did, they took to escorting the men to the toilet in relays, like protective parents. What they were not able to prevent was an intelligence officer in a bosun's uniform making an offer of asylum. Anyone who wished to remain in the United States would be permitted to do so. It took 10 minutes for the information to spread through the crew. When it came time for the American crewmen to eat, the Russian officers could hardly prohibit contact, and it turned out that the officers themselves got very little to eat. So busy were they patrolling the mess tables. To the bemused surprise of their American counterparts, they were forced to decline repeated invitations to the Pigeon's wardroom. The Pigeon docked carefully. There was no hurry. As the gangway was set in place, the band on the dock played a selection of Soviet and American airs to mark the cooperative nature of the rescue mission. The Soviets had expected that their arrival would be a quiet one, given the time of day. They were mistaken in this. When the first Soviet officer was halfway down the gangway, he was dazzled by 50 high-intensity television lights and the shouted questions of television reporters rousted out of bed to meet the rescue ship, and so have a bright piece of Christmas season news for the morning network broadcasts. The Russians had never encountered anything like Western newsmen before, and the resulting cultural collision was total chaos. Reporters singled out the officers, blocking their paths, to the consternation of Marines trying to keep control of things. To a man, the officers pretended not to know a word of English, only to find that an enterprising reporter had brought along a Russian language professor from the University of South Carolina in Columbia. Petrov found himself stumbling through politically acceptable platitudes in front of a half-dozen cameras and wishing the entire affair were the bad dream it seemed to be. It took an hour to get every Russian sailor aboard the 3 buses chartered for the purpose and off to the airport. Along the way, cars and vans filled with news crews raced alongside the buses, continuing to annoy the Russians with camera lights and further shouted questions that no one could understand. The scene at the airport was not much different. The Air Force had sent down a VC-135 transport, but before the Russians could board it, they again had to jostle their way through a sea of reporters. Ivanov found himself confronted with a Slavic language expert whose Russian was marred by a horrendous accent.
Boarding took another half hour. A dozen Air Force officers got everyone seated and passed out cigarettes and liquor miniatures. By the time the VIP transport reached 20,000 feet, it was a very happy flight. An officer spoke to them over the intercom system, explaining what was to happen. Medical checks would be made of everyone. The Soviet Union would be sending a plane for them the next day, but everyone hoped their stay might be extended a day or two so that they might experience American hospitality in full. The flight crew outdid itself, telling their passengers the history of every landmark, town, village, interstate highway, and truck stop on the flight route, proclaiming through the interpreter the wish of all Americans for peaceful, friendly relations with the Soviet Union, expressing the professional admiration of the U.S. Air Force for the courage of the Soviet seamen, and mourning the deaths of the officers who had courageously lingered behind, allowing their men to go first. The whole affair was a masterpiece of duplicity aimed at overwhelming them, and it began to succeed. The aircraft flew low over the Washington suburbs while approaching Andrews Air Force Base. The interpreter explained that they were flying over middle-class homes that belonged to ordinary workers in government and local industry. Three more buses awaited them on the ground, and instead of driving on the beltway around Washington, D.C., the buses drove directly through town. American officers on each bus apologized for the traffic jams, telling the passengers that nearly every American family has one car, many two or more, and that people only use public transportation to avoid the nuisance of driving. The nuisance of driving one's own car, the Soviet seamen thought in amazement. Their political officers might later tell them that this was a total lie, but who could deny the thousands of cars on the road? Surely this could not all be a sham staged for the benefit of a few sailors on an hour's notice. Driving throughout southeast D.C., they noted that black people owned cars, scarcely had room to park them all. The bus continued down the mall, with the interpreters voicing the hope that they would be allowed to see the many museums open to everyone. The Air and Space Museum, it was mentioned, had a moon rock brought back by the Apollo astronauts. The Soviets saw the joggers in the mall and the thousands of people casually strolling around. They jabbered among themselves as the buses turned north towards Bethesda through the nicer sections of northwest Washington. At Bethesda, they were met by television crews broadcasting live over all three networks and by friendly, smiling U.S. Navy doctors and orderlies who led them into the hospital for medical checks. 10 embassy officials were there, wondering how to control the group, but politically unable to protest at the attention given their men in the spirit of détente. Doctors had been brought in from Walter Reed and other government hospitals to give each man a quick and thorough medical examination, particularly to check for radiation poisoning. Along the way, each man found himself alone with a U.S. Navy officer who asked politely if that individual might wish to stay in the United States, pointing out that each man making this decision would be required to make his intentions known in person to a representative of the Soviet embassy, but that if he wished to do so, he would be permitted to stay. To the fury of the embassy officials, four men made this decision, one recanting after a confrontation with the naval attaché. The Americans had been careful to have each meeting videotaped so that later accusations of intimidation could be refuted at once. When the medical checks were completed, thankfully radiation exposure levels had been slight, the men were again fed and bedded down. Washington, D.C.
"Good morning, Mr. Ambassador," the president said.
Arbatov noted that again Dr. Pelt was standing at his master's side behind the large antique desk. He had not expected this meeting to be a pleasant one.
"Mr. President, I am here to protest the attempted kidnapping of our seamen by the United States government."
"Mr. Ambassador," the president responded sharply, "in the eyes of a former district attorney, kidnapping is a vile and loathsome crime, and the government of the United States of America will not be accused of such a thing, certainly not in this office. We have not, do not, and never will kidnap people. Is that clear to you, sir?"
"Besides which, Alex," Pelt said less forcefully, "the men to whom you refer would not be alive were it not for us.
We lost two good men rescuing your servicemen. You might at least express some appreciation for our efforts to save your crew, and perhaps make a gesture of sympathy for the Americans who lost their lives in the process.
My government notes the heroic effort of your two officers, and does wish to express its appreciation and that of the Soviet people for the rescue. Even so, gentlemen, deliberate efforts have been made to entice some of those men to betray their country.
Mr. Ambassador, when your trawler rescued the crew of our patrol plane last year, officers of the Soviet armed forces offered money, women, and other enticements to our crewmen if they would give out information or agree to stay behind in Vladivostok, correct? Don't tell me that you have no knowledge of this. You know that's how the game is played. At the time, we did not object to this, did we? No, we were sufficiently grateful that those six men were still alive, and now, of course, all of them are back at work. We remain grateful for your country's humanitarian concern for the lives of ordinary American citizens. In this case, each officer and enlisted man was told that he could stay if he wished to do so. No force of any kind was used. Each man wishing to remain was required by us to meet with an official of your embassy so as to give a fair chance to explain to him the error of his ways. Surely this is fair, Mr. Ambassador. We made no offers of money or women. We do not buy people, and we damned well do not ever kidnap people. Kidnappers are people I put in jail. I even managed to have one executed. Don't you ever accuse me of that again. The President concluded righteously.
My government insists that all our men be returned to their homeland, Arbatov persisted.
Mr. Ambassador, any person in the United States, regardless of his nationality or the manner of his arrival, is entitled to the full protection of our law. Our courts have ruled on this many times, and under our law, no man or woman may be compelled to do something against his will without due process. The subject is closed. Now, I have a question for you. What was a ballistic missile submarine doing 300 miles from the American coast?
A missile submarine, Mr. President?
Pelt lifted a photograph from the President's desk and handed it to Arbatov. Taken from the tape recorder on the sea cliff, it showed the SSN-20 sea-launched ballistic missile. The name of the submarine was Red October, Pelt said. It exploded and sank 300 miles from the coast of South Carolina. Alex, we have an agreement between our two countries that no such vessel will approach either country to within 500 miles, 800 kilometers. We want to know what that submarine was doing there. Don't try to tell us that this missile is some kind of fabrication. Even if we had wanted to do such a foolish thing, we wouldn't have had the time. That's one of your missiles, Mr. Ambassador. And the submarine carried 19 more just like it. Pelt deliberately misstated the number. And the government of the United States asks the government of the Soviet Union how it came to be there, in violation of our agreement, while so many other of your ships are so close to our Atlantic coast.
That must be the lost submarine, Arbatov offered.
Mr. Ambassador, the President said softly, the submarine was not lost until Thursday, 7 days after you told us about it. In short, Mr. Ambassador, your explanation of last Friday does not coincide with the facts we have physically established.
What accusations are you making? Arbatov bristled.
Why none, Alex, the President said. If that agreement is no longer operative, then it is no longer operative. I believe we discussed that possibility last week also. The American people will know later today what the facts are. You are sufficiently familiar with our country to imagine their reaction. I will have an explanation. For the moment, I see no further reason for your fleet to be off our coast. The rescue has been successfully concluded, and the further presence of the Soviet fleet can only be a provocation. I want you and your government to consider what my military commanders are telling me right now, or, if you prefer, what your commanders would be telling General Secretary Narmanov if the situation were reversed. I will have an explanation. Without one, I can reach one of only a few conclusions,
and those are conclusions I would prefer not to choose from. Send that message to your government and tell them that since some of your men have opted to stay here, we'll probably find out what was really happening in short order. Good day." Arbatov left the office, turning left to leave by the west entrance. A marine guard held the door open, a polite gesture that stopped short of his eyes. The ambassador's driver, waiting outside in a Cadillac limousine, held the door open for him. The driver was chief of the KGB's political intelligence section at that organization's Washington station. "So," he said, checking traffic on Pennsylvania Avenue before making a left turn. "So the meeting went exactly as I had predicted, and now we can be absolutely certain why they are kidnapping our men," Arbatov replied. "And that is, Comrade Ambassador?" the driver prompted. He did not let his irritation show. Only a few years before, this party hack would not have dared temporize with a senior KGB officer. It was a disgrace, what had happened to the Committee for State Security since the death of Comrade Andropov. But things would be set right again. He was certain of that. "The President all but accused us of sending the submarine deliberately to their shore in violation of our secret 1979 protocol. They are holding our men to interrogate them, to take their heads apart so that they can learn what the submarine's orders were. How long will that take, CIA? A day? Two?" Arbatov shook his head angrily. "They may know already. A few drugs, a woman, perhaps, to loosen their tongues. The President also invited Moscow to imagine what the Pentagon hotheads are telling him to think and telling him to do. No mystery there, is there? They will say we were rehearsing a surprise nuclear attack, perhaps even executing one, as if we were not working harder than they to achieve peaceful coexistence. Suspicious fools. They are fearful about what has happened, and even more angry." "Can you blame them, comrade?" the driver asked, taking all of this in, filing, analyzing, composing his independent report to Moscow Center. "And he said that there was no further reason for our fleet to be off their coast." "How did he say this? Was it a demand?" "His words were soft, softer than I expected. This concerns me. They are planning something, I think. Rattling a saber makes noise, drawing it does not. He demands an explanation for this entire affair. What do I tell him? What was happening?" "I suspect that we will never know." The senior agent did know. The original story, that is, incredible as it was. That the Navy and the GRU could allow such a fantastic error to take place had amazed him. The story from Agent Cassius was scarcely less mad. The driver had passed it on to Moscow himself. Was it possible that the United States and the Soviet Union were both victims of a third party? An operation gone awry, and the Americans trying to find out who was responsible and how it was done so that they might try to do it themselves? That part of the story made sense. But did the rest? He frowned at the traffic. He had orders from Moscow Center. If this was a CIA operation, he was supposed to find out immediately. He didn't believe it was. If so, the CIA was being unusually effective in covering it. Was it possible to cover such a complex operation? He didn't think so. Regardless, he and his colleagues would be working for several weeks to penetrate any cover there was, to find out what was being said in Langley and in the field, while other KGB sections did the same throughout the world. If the CIA had penetrated the Northern Fleet's high command, he'd find out. Of that, he was confident. He could almost wish they had done so. The GRU would be responsible for the disaster, and would be disgraced after profiting from the KGB's loss of prestige a few years back. If he was reading the situation correctly, the Politburo was turning the KGB loose on the GRU and the military, allowing Moscow Center to initiate its own independent investigation of the affair. Regardless of what was found, the KGB would come out ahead and deflate the armed services. One way or another, his organization would discover what had taken place, and if it was damaging to his rivals, so much the better.
When the door closed behind the Soviet ambassador, Dr. Pelt opened a side door to the Oval Office. Judge Moore came in.
Mr. President, it's been a while since I've had to do things like hide in closets.
You really expect this to work? Pelt said.
Yes, I do now.
Moore settled comfortably into a leather chair.
Isn't this a little shaky, Judge? Pelt asked. I mean, running an operation this complex?
That's the beauty of it, Doctor. We're not running anything. The Soviets will be doing that for us. Oh, sure, we'll have a lot of our people prowling around Eastern Europe asking a lot of questions. So will Sir Basil's fellows. The French and the Israelis already are, because we've asked them if they know what's happening with the stray missile sub. The KGB will find out quickly enough and wonder why the four main Western intelligence agencies are all asking the same questions, instead of pulling into their shells like they'd expect them to if this were our operation.
You have to appreciate the dilemma the Soviets face, a choice between the two equally unattractive scenarios. On the other hand, they can choose to believe that one of their most trusted professional officers has committed high treason on an unprecedented scale. You've seen our file on Captain Ramis. He's the communist version of an Eagle Scout, a genuine new Soviet man. Add to that the fact that a defection conspiracy necessarily involves a number of equally trusted officers. The Soviets have a mind block against believing that individuals of this type will ever leave the workers' paradise. That seems paradoxical, I admit, given the strenuous efforts they expend to keep people from leaving their country. But it's true. Losing a ballet dancer or a KGB agent is one thing. Losing the son of a Politburo member, an officer with nearly 30 years of unblemished service, is quite another. Moreover, a naval captain has a lot of privileges. You might call his defection the equivalent of a self-made millionaire leaving New York to live in Moscow. They simply will not believe it. On the other hand, they can believe the story we planted through Henderson, which is also unattractive but is supported by a good deal of circumstantial evidence, especially our efforts to entice their crewmen to defect. You saw how furious they are about that. The way they think, this is a gross violation of the rules of civilized behavior. The President's forceful reaction to our discovery that this was a missile submarine is also evidence that favors Henderson's story.
So what side will they come down on? The President asked.
That, sir, is a question of psychology more than anything else, and the Soviet psychology is very hard for us to read. Given the choice between the collective treason of 10 men and an outside conspiracy, my opinion is that they will prefer the latter. For them to believe that this really was a defection, well, it would force them to re-examine their own beliefs. Who likes to do that? Moore gestured grandly. The latter alternative means that their security has been violated by outsiders. But being a victim is more palatable than having to recognize the intrinsic contradictions of their own governing philosophy. On top of that, we have the fact that the KGB will be running the investigation.
Why? Pelt asked, caught up in the judge's plot.
In either case, a defection or a penetration of naval operational security, the GRU would have been responsible. Security of the naval and military forces is their bailiwick, the more so with the damage done to the KGB after the departure of our friend Andropov. The Soviets can't have an organization investigating itself, not in their intelligence community. So, the KGB will be looking to take its rival service apart. From the KGB's perspective, outside instigation is the far more attractive alternative. It makes for a bigger operation. If they confirm Henderson's story and convince everyone that it's true, and they will, of course, it makes them look all that much better for having uncovered it.
They will confirm the story.
Of course they will. In the intelligence business, if you look hard enough for something, you find it, whether it's really there or not. Lord, we owe this Ramius fellow more than he will ever know. An opportunity like this doesn't come along once in a generation. We simply can't lose.
But the KGB will emerge stronger, Pelt observed. Is that a good thing?
Moore shrugged. Bound to happen eventually. Unseating and possibly killing Andropov gave the military services too much prestige,
Just like with Beria back in the 50s, the Soviets depend on political control of their military as much as we do. More. Having the KGB take their high command apart gets the dirty work done for them. It had to happen anyway, so it's just as well that we can profit by it. There's only a few more things we have to do.
Such as? The president asked. Our friend Henderson would leak information in a month or so, saying that we had a submarine tracking Red October all the way from Iceland.
But why? Pelt objected. Then they'll know that we were lying, that all the excitement over the missile sub was a lie.
Not exactly, Doctor, Moore said. Having a missile sub this close to our coast remains a violation of the agreement, and from their point of view, we have no way of knowing why she was there until we interrogate the crewmen remaining behind, who will probably tell us little of value. The Soviets will expect that we have not been completely truthful with them on this affair. The fact that we were trailing their sub and were ready to destroy it at any time gives them the evidence of our duplicity that they'll be looking for. We'll also say that Dallas monitored the reactor incident on sonar, and that will explain the proximity of our rescue ship. They know, well, they certainly suspect, that we have concealed something. This will mislead them about what it was we really concealed. The Russians have a saying for this. They call it wolf meat. And they will launch an extensive operation to penetrate our operation, whatever it is. But they will find nothing. The only people in the CIA who know what is really going on here are Greer, Ritter, and myself. Our operations people have orders to find out what was going on. And that's all that can leak out.
What about Henderson? And how many of our people know about the submarine? The president asked.
If Henderson spills anything to them, he'll be signing his own death warrant. The KGB deals severely with double agents, and would not believe that we tricked him into delivering false information. He knows it, and we'll be keeping a close eye on him in any case. How many of our people know about the sub? 100, perhaps? And the number will increase somewhat, but remember that they think we now have 2 dead Soviet subs off our coast, and they have every reason to believe that whatever Soviet sub equipment turns up in our labs has been recovered from the ocean floor. We will, of course, be reactivating the Glomar Explorer for just that purpose. They'd be suspicious if we didn't. Why disappoint them? Sooner or later, they just might figure the whole story out, but by that time, the stripped hulk will be at the bottom of the sea.
So we can't keep this a secret forever? Pelt asked.
Forever's a long time. We have to plan for the possibility. For the immediate future, the secret should be fairly safe, what with only 100 people in on it. In a year minimum, more likely 2 or 3, they may have accumulated enough data to suspect what has happened, but by that time there won't be much physical evidence to point to. Moreover, if the KGB discovers the truth, will they want to report it? With a GRU to find out, they certainly would, and the resulting chaos within their intelligence community would also work to our benefit. Moore took a cigar from a leather holder. As I said, Ramius has given us a fantastic opportunity on several levels, and the beauty of it is that we don't have to do much of anything. The Russians will be doing all the legwork, looking for something that isn't there.
What about the defectors, Judge? The president asked.
They, Mr. President, will be taken care of. We know how to do this, and we rarely have a complaint about the CIA's hospitality. We'll take some months to debrief them, and at the same time, we'll be preparing them for life in America. They'll get new identities, re-education, cosmetic surgery if necessary, and they'll never have to work another day as long as they live. But they will want to work. Almost all of them do. I expect the Navy will find places for them, paid consultants for their submarine warfare department, that sort of thing.
I want to meet them, the president said impulsively.
That can be arranged, sir, but it will have to be discreet, Moore cautioned.
Camp David, that ought to be secure enough. And Ryan, Judge, I want him taken care of.
Understood, sir. We're bringing him along rather quickly already. He has a big future with us.
To Yuritum, USSR.
The reason Red October had been ordered to dive long before dawn was orbiting the Earth at a height of 800 kilometers. The size of a Greyhound bus, Albatross 8, had been sent aloft 11 months earlier by a heavy-lift booster from the Cosmodrome at Tyuratam. The massive satellite, called RORSAT, for Radar Ocean Reconnaissance Satellite, was specifically designed for maritime surveillance. Albatross 8 passed over Pamlico Sound at 11:31 local time. Its onboard programming was designed to trace thermal receptors over the entire visible horizon, interrogating everything in sight and locking on any signature that fitted its acquisition parameters. As it continued on its orbit and passed over elements of the U.S. fleet, the New Jersey's jammers were aimed upward to scramble its signal. The satellite's tape systems dutifully recorded this. The jamming would tell the operators something about American electronic warfare systems. As Albatross 8 crossed the pole, the parabolic dish on its front tracked in on the carrier signal of another bird, the Iskra, communication satellite. When the reconnaissance satellite located its higher-flying cousin, a laser side link transmitted the contents of the Albatross's tape bank. The Iskra immediately relayed this to the ground station at Tyuratam. The signal was also received by a 15-meter dish located in western China, which was operated by the U.S. National Security Agency in cooperation with the Chinese, who used the data received for their own purposes. The Americans transmitted it via their own communication satellite to NSA headquarters at Fort Meade, Maryland. At almost the same time, the digital signal was examined by two teams of experts 5,000 miles apart.
"Clear weather," a technician moaned. "Now we get clear weather."
"Enjoy it while you can, comrade."
His neighbor at the next console was watching data from a geosynchronous weather satellite that monitored the Western Hemisphere. Knowing the weather over a hostile country can have great strategic value.
"There's another cold front approaching their coast. Their winter has been like ours. I hope they are enjoying it."
"Our men at sea will not."
The technician mentally shuddered at the thought of being at sea in a major storm. He'd taken a Black Sea cruise the previous summer and become hopelessly seasick.
"Aha! What is this? Colonel?"
"Yes, comrade."
The colonel supervising the watch came over quickly.
"See here, comrade colonel."
The technician traced a finger on the TV screen.
"This is Pamlico Sound on the central coast of the United States. Look here, comrade."
The thermal image of the water on the screen was black, but as the technician adjusted the display, it changed to green, with two white patches, one larger than the other. Twice, the large one split into two segments. The image was of the surface of the water, and some of the water was half a degree warmer than it should have been. The differential was not constant, but it did return enough to prove that something was adding heat to the water.
"Sunlight, perhaps?"
the colonel asked.
"No, comrade, the clear sky gives even sunlight to the entire area,"
the technician said quietly. He was always quiet when he thought he was onto something.
"Two submarines, perhaps three, 30 meters under the water."
"You are certain?"
The technician flipped on a switch to display the radar picture, which showed only the corduroy pattern of small waves.
"There is nothing on the water to generate this heat, comrade colonel. Therefore, it must be something under the water. The time of year is wrong for mating whales. It can only be nuclear submarines, probably two, perhaps three. I speculate, colonel, that the Americans have been sufficiently frightened by the deployment of our fleet to seek shelter for their missile submarines. Their missile sub-base is only a few hundred kilometers south. Perhaps one of their Ohio-class boats has taken shelter here and is being protected by a Hunter sub, as ours are."
"Then he will soon move out. Our fleet is being recalled."
"Too bad. It would be good to track him." "This is a rare opportunity, comrade colonel."
"Indeed. Well done, comrade academician."
10 minutes later, the data had been transmitted to Moscow. Soviet Naval High Command, Moscow.
"We will make use of this opportunity, comrade," Gorshkov said. We are now recalling our fleet, and we will allow several submarines to remain behind to gather electronic intelligence. The Americans will probably lose several in the shuffle.
Quite likely, the chief of fleet operations said.
The Ohio will go south, probably to their submarine base at Charleston or Kings Bay, or north to Norfolk. We have Konovalov at Norfolk and Shibilikov off Charleston. Both will stay in place for several days, I think. We must do something right to show the politicians that we have a real navy. Being able to track on an Ohio would be a beginning.
I'll have the orders out in 15 minutes, comrade. The chief of operations thought this was a good idea. He had not liked the report of the Politburo meeting that he'd gotten from Gorshkov. Though if Sergei were on his way out, he would be in a good place to take over the job. The New Jersey. The Red Rocket message had arrived in Eaton's hand only moments before. Moscow had just transmitted a lengthy operational order via satellite to the Soviet fleet. Now the Russians were in a real fix, the Commodore thought. Around them were three carrier battle groups, the Kennedy, America, and Nimitz, all under Josh Painter's command. Eaton had them in sight, and had operational control of the Tarawa to augment his own surface action group. The Commodore turned his binoculars on the Kirov.
Commander, bring the group to battle stations.
Aye, the group operations officer lifted the tactical radio mic.
Blue boys, this is Blue King. Amber light, execute, out.
Eaton waited 4 seconds for the New Jersey's general quarters alarm to sound. The crew raced to their guns.
Range to Kirov.
37,600 yards, sir. We've been sneaking in a laser range every few minutes.
We're dialed in, sir, the group operations officer reported. Main battery turrets are still loaded with sabots, and the gunnery's been updating the solution every 30 seconds.
A phone buzzed next to Eaton's command chair on the flag bridge.
Eaton.
All stations manned and ready, Commodore, the battleship's captain reported. Eaton looked at his stopwatch.
Well done, Captain. We've got the men drilled very well indeed.
In the New Jersey's Combat Information Center, the numerical displays showed the exact range to the Kirov's main mast. The logical first target is always the enemy flagship. The only question was how much punishment the Kirov could absorb, and what would kill her first, the gun rounds or the Tomahawk missiles. The important part, the gunnery officer had been saying for days, was to kill the Kirov before any aircraft could interfere. The New Jersey had never sunk a ship all on her own. 40 years was a long time to wait.
They're turning, the group operations officer said.
Yep, let's see how far. The Kirov's formation had been on a westerly course when the signal arrived. Every ship in the circular array turned to starboard, all together. Their turns stopped when they reached a heading of 040. Eaton set his glasses down in the holder.
They're going home.
Let's inform Washington and keep the men at stations for a while. Dulles International Airport. The Soviets outdid themselves getting their men away from the United States. An Aeroflot Ilyushin IL-62 was taken out of regular international service and sent directly from Moscow to Dulles. It landed at sunset. A near copy of the British VC-10, the four-engine aircraft, taxied to the remotest service area for refueling. Along with some other passengers who did not leave the plane to stretch their legs, a spare flight crew was brought along so that the plane could immediately return home. A pair of mobile lounges drove from the terminal building 2 miles to the waiting aircraft. Inside them, the crewmen of the Red October looked out at the snow-dusted countryside, knowing this was their final look at America. They were quiet, having been roused from their bed in Bethesda and taken by bus to Dulles only an hour earlier. This time, no reporters harassed them. The four officers, 9 Mishmani, and the remaining enlisted crew were split into distinct groups as they boarded. Each group was taken to a separate part of the aircraft. Each officer and Mishman had his own KGB interrogator, and the debriefing began as the aircraft started its takeoff roll. By the time the Ilyushin reached cruising altitude, most of the crewmen were asking themselves why they had not opted to remain behind with their traitorous countrymen. These interviews were decidedly unpleasant.
"Did Captain Ronius act strangely